Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Nagler's never right yet again. True goodness for you today. Had a great chat with Field Yates over at ESPN. I could have gone on for hours with this guy. He gave me an hour as it was. Let's dive right in. This is just two guys talking football. True NFL goodness. Mr. Field Yates on Nagler's never right.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Easy.
All right, everyone, you see him in the afternoon on your television, one of the NFL insiders for ESPN, NFL reporter at ESPN.com. It's Mr. Field Yates. Field, how the hell are you today?
I'm doing great, Aaron. It's, 36 hours at the time of this recording before the draft gets started, so my mind is on, process overload with rumors and speculation, but it feels good to know that the hay is sort of in the barn for the draft,
right.
And we can actually pick these players, or not we, but the teams can actually pick these players, and then we can get on to 4.5 months of speculating upon which team will rise in the standings like the Bucks were supposed to last year and then fall flat in our faces when the Bucks end up picking first overall.
Oh, yes. Some of our brethren picking the Bucks last year to make the playoffs. I'm not going to name any names, but those who did will never live it down. Let's give people a brief background on yourself. I know it's funny because you're the new kid on the block, so to speak, there at the old ESPN campus. It's funny, you do a cursory search of your name and you find SB Nation and Bleacher Report profiles. What is your path? How did you go from having your own blog to sitting there at the desk at ESPN?
Yeah, I have to Google search myself more frequently, it sounds like. I haven't checked that in a while, and I think I should have like a designated relative who's in charge of that sort of stuff,
As you get bigger, as your empire expands, I'm sure that'll happen.
That's on my to-do list for the rest of the offseason. So I kind of grew up around football. I started, I think the first time I ball boyed at a Patriots mini camp. I think it might have even been a rookie camp in I want to say when I was 14 years old. I just turned 28 recently. So 2001, maybe even right after the Patriots' first Super Bowl, maybe it was 13 years ago, I started ball boying and pestering anybody that I could to stick around Patriots mini camps and anything else around their stadium. I grew up outside of Boston in a town called Weston, for those who might be from this area. And then by the time I'd gotten to my leading into my senior year of high school, I was able to land a gig with the Patriots. I guess I called it internship, but it wasn't something I applied through online, just happened to know a couple of the right people at the right time in the right place. And I would call it sort of a scouting internship, if we want to keep borrowing that term. Mm-hmm. And it was basically hey, you think you want to be a scout or a head coach? Or really a head coach one day was my goal growing up. Let's teach you, let's go from the bottom up. So my first summer, basically, and I mentioned this to you on Twitter recently, was besides going to practice and taking notes and speaking to people and learning and picking people's brains, was basically just taking college tapes. And at this point, it was still beta tapes, so nothing was digital. It
old
was taking
school, baby.
Yeah,
love these, it.
Yeah, and not even. And I suppose some people would say that's not 9mm or anything. This is sort of old school. I would take the tapes and I'd cut them up, and what we call our point of attack tapes, which were basically, you find a prospect who's worth potentially drafting, and then your job in my position was to go through for receivers and defensive backs, it was 6 games. For linemen, it was 3 games. And everything else in between, it sort of depended upon the position and the player's production. You'd go and you'd find the good, bad, and the ugly. Basically, all the plays you could actually evaluate this guy on, and you'd turn him into a point of attack tape, kind of like a highlight, low light tape. And pass it along to the people that were actually making a decision on these players. At that time, Scott Pioli was still basically overseeing the Patriots personnel department in the same way that Nick Caserio does for them. And then so I continued to do that each summer, that internship, and sort of grew into more responsibility each year through when I graduated college in 2009. I went to Wesleyan, which is a small school here in Connecticut up in the Northeast. And then after that, I got hired by Pioli in Kansas City to basically be one of their entry-level scouting guys. We called it an in-house scout, scouting assistant. There, probably a grunt would work as well in terms of a title.
Right.
I spent a couple years there, and sort of it was a continuation of what I'd done, and it, you know, it was neat. There's certainly a difference between, you know, being somewhere for, you know, 6 weeks of training camp or you know, right. I used to go during my winter breaks and stuff like that. I'd go home and do some work for the Patriots when I could. But there's a whole different ballgame when you're working at it, living it. And so my first, you know, basically my job was continuation of scouting duties, making those tapes. I got to do a couple local school visits. You do things like if we were bringing in a guy for a workout, a veteran player, you handle all the coordination of that. You know, if when we had our 30 visits before the draft, you know, it was my job to go pick up the guys at the airport, get them to the hospital for medical stuff, anywhere they needed to be. I was sort of their liaison. So it was a good way to learn everything or learn a lot of things, right. And feel like you had some semblance of responsibility. After a couple of years, I don't know if it was a light bulb moment. I'm not sure how I would perfectly describe it, but I realized that maybe there was a way, like I've always loved football. Football's been very good to me throughout my life. Maybe there was a way for me to continue to love football but not live football, if that makes sense. You know,
well, yeah,
and because I have interests outside of the game that I wanted to explore, and I was so grateful for my opportunity out there, but I also felt like maybe there was a possibility for me to segue into something different that might be, you know, closer, that would allow me to live a lifestyle that I sort of valued from a long time growing up. And I ended up at ESPN like 16 months later after, as you mentioned, I started my own blog, and I didn't really have a direction for it more so than just like, let's make it about football. Guys at Bleacher Report, guys at SB Nation, people sort of were letting me come on and do some contributions in a variety of capacities, as you remember.
I remember, and I remember that blog. It was Field Notes, was that it?
It was Thoughts from the Field.
Thoughts from the Field.
The most creative thing I've ever come up with is Thoughts from the Field. You know, I might have to rekindle that in some capacity.
It was
one
good
day.
Stuff. I remember reading it.
Yeah, it was sort of fun. It was a way to, like, some days it was news, some days it was analysis, some days it was just whatever I felt like. And so Mike Reese, who people should know if they follow the Patriots.
One of the best beat writers out there.
Yeah, for my money, he's just the greatest. And before I reached out to him, and I always tell this story because I think it's important to sort of, it's a good lesson, I thought, was I reached out to God knows how many local papers, websites, TV stations, radio stations, etc. And I heard back from maybe one or two others in some capacity, but it was mostly just like, hey, thanks, kid. Like, good luck on your way. Right. Literally, in less than 11 minutes after I emailed Mike Reese, he had gotten back to me and said, hey, I'm going to keep you on my radar. If you don't mind, let's be patient here. We'll catch up after the season. This was when the Patriots were playing the Giants in the Super Bowl the second time. So he said, I'm going to be pretty floored through then. So we ended up, and of course, I think to myself, this is the greatest thing ever. I'm going to email him after the season. I'm going to give him, you know, like 2 weeks to come back rest a little bit. It had been a crazy year for the Patriots, et cetera. And I'm like 3 days after the season was over, I get another email from Mike. And he's like, hey, just, you know, I still haven't forgotten about you. So anyway, that's a long way of telling the story how Mike and I linked up. And I started doing some stuff with him during the 2012 NFL draft down at Patriot Stadium. And one thing that's neat about ESPN is, once you get in, it's not, you know, you can do one thing, let's keep you there. It's, can you do two things? Can you do five things?
The more
can you do 10 things?
Hey, it's the same on a football field.
Yeah, no. Exactly. So I've been really lucky to have, you know, I don't know how some of the other roles specifically developed. That's a question that I'm sort of frequently asked. And I'm not sure the right answer other than it's like, hey, I found that if you have an approach and you have a dedication to football, you know, you don't like, if I'm not the hot take master. I'm not, you know, I don't spend too much time. I would say I don't want to say that I'm just purely positive in every approach that I take. But like one thing that I learned from being on the inside and taking it to the outside is every move that you make when you're on the inside with an NFL team, you're making for a reason. And so my goal when I'm analyzing it on the outside or no longer working in the league is, all right, this move sounds really dumb right now, or may sound really dumb right now, whether it's a guy getting too much money in free agency, a player being quote-unquote overdrafted, releasing a veteran, whatever it is.
Right.
My goal is like, okay, rather than tearing them apart for this move, can I figure out why they might have made this move? And some of them turn out to be, you know, unwise. I remember when the Bears gave Jay Cutler a huge extension, I was thinking to myself, you know, I justified it trying to go through the mind of Phil Emery, who I worked with in Kansas City and was the Bears GM. And now, you know, whatever it is, 2 years later, we know that it was a mistake, and it's going to...
Yeah, but, I mean, speaking of the Cutler move, in particular, I mean, they were caught between a rock and a hard place because it wasn't like they could start over. Because if they did start over, they were relegating themselves, you know, to kind of the dustbin. They knew that they had to pay him. That's always been the thing. And it's the situation they're in now. It's not like, it's all well and good to say we need to move on from Jay Cutler. But if they don't have somebody in the hopper, and they haven't, I mean, maybe they did with Josh McCown, but you saw how he fell apart down in Tampa. I mean, to me, that's always been kind of a false narrative in that, oh, well, you know, they made this huge mistake with Cutler. Well, they didn't really have much of a choice.
Yeah, it's always opportunity cost, right? It's like, yeah, you're passing on this guy in the draft, or you're not signing this guy, or you are signing this guy, and the alternative is this. So that was probably way too long-winded of a way to describe sort of what I do, how I approach
it. Man, it's the internet. You can talk as long as you want.
All right, good.
This isn't your little, you know, you got a 2 minutes to respond to Lewis Rednick or something. I mean, we can just talk, man.
I was gonna say,
that's what's great about the podcast.
The only limiting part is when you get on Twitter and someone, like, you know, berates you. I get a lot of that. I think I found myself to be...
You're taking an unusual amount of abuse for a guy who's, as you said, like, tries to be even-tempered and positive in your approach. You attract some real assholes.
Like, I don't know what it is. I actually think the funniest part is I think the two things that people get mad about most are my name and my age, because I am 28, which is young, but I also look like I'm, you know, like 19.
You look like you're 12. Come on.
Yeah.
I get a lot of
it seems to be like two things that are entirely out of my control generate more negative attention on Twitter than anything else. And as you know, and we're Facebook friends and Instagram buddies, and I like to make light of it because if you don't have thick skin in this business, it's going to be, you know, a quick tenure for you. So I found that rather than what was really the tipping point for me was someone tweeted something like, you know, I effing hate you, Field Yates, you suck. And I'm thinking to myself, let me give this like an honest assessment. And so I responded back via Twitter and I said, you know, I'm genuinely curious, what is it about me that you don't like? And the response was, I don't know. I just don't like you. And I said, from then on, it was like, all right.
Yep.
Here we go. Well, the answer, you just answered my question for me in multiple ways. So I'm never going
to
get down about someone telling me that.
Never have to worry about the trolls again. Absolutely. Yep. All right. Well, you mentioned your work, you know, not only with the Patriots, but covering them. Speaking of the Patriots, I wanted to ask if you were surprised that the Patriots let Darrell Revis go this offseason. Because I think coming into the offseason, a lot of people had assumed, I remember talking to Tony Richardson, who had, you know, been good friends with Darrell at one point, I think they still are, he had spoken to him and about, you know, creating a legacy and sticking in a great situation where obviously he's won one ring and probably if he stuck around could maybe win another, etc. It seemed to be a foregone conclusion heading into the offseason that no, there was no way they were going to pay the $20 million or whatever, but there was going to be some common ground and they were going to figure it out. I mean, I think not everybody, but a lot of people who in and around the league thought that's what was going to happen. And then, lo and behold, the exact opposite happens. And, of course, he comes right back to New York here with the Jets. And to me, I guess I wasn't surprised in the sense that he's always been kind of a mercenary, always kind of operated in that fashion in regards to, you know, he's got the skill set to demand, you know, basically what he wants from the highest bidder. And he's pretty much worked it pretty well throughout his entire career. But I thought for sure that this time he would maybe take a little less and stay with the Patriots. But I was dead wrong. And I was just wondering if someone has, you know, worked for and covered the team, were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised when it first happened. So, you know, the decision, when we say the Patriots let him go this offseason, you know, the part, like their part in that was not exercising 2015 option. Which was, as you mentioned, it was $20 million in terms of salary for Revis and then $25 million in terms of a cap hit. So the Patriots model, not that this needs to be rehashed 100 times over, but, you know, it's basically it's there's always a price and you always make good decisions relative to a player's value. You can't be emotional as easy as it would have been for them to bring him back. And even if you bring him back and it's at the risk of other players or the cost of other players, fans are excited, et cetera. And Revis is, I mean, he's rare.
And he changed their defense. I mean, let's be honest. When you look at their season the year before, losing in the AFC Championship game to the Broncos, I mean, even forget before Tlaib goes down, I mean, their secondary just was not very good.
Yep.
And then they go out and get Revis and Browner, and the whole thing changed, A, how they could play defense, and B, how effective it was. So that, more than anything, is why I thought the Pats would kind of maybe bend or break a rule. Because let's face it, I mean, we've seen time and again, yes, Bill does a great job of, you know, kind of patchworking that secondary, and it has gotten them far several times, but that's really been an Achilles heel for that team over the years.
Yeah, and they've had trouble drafting guys of late, especially a cornerback. You know, they've had some luck in the later parts of the rounds, but, you know, the Rozai Dowlings of the world, and the, you know, the Donald right. Butler, who ends up now a pretty good player, Darius Butler, excuse me, ends up a pretty good player now with Indianapolis after some time in Carolina, but when he was with the Patriots, it was a second-round flub. I was surprised. I definitely was. But the more I've learned about the situation after the fact, my sense is that Revis was pretty set on going to New York at some point during this past year. And whether that moment was specifically after he got that title, because it was, you know, it's a one more box checked in right. terms of his Hall of Fame legacy yep. or resume, et cetera, or whether it was at some point during the season where he said, you know, I've been a part of enough wins, people respect me in this regard, now I can, whatever it was. It really seems like he was intent on going back to New York. Except for, it doesn't matter if it was Rex Ryan, Todd Bowles, or you and I coaching the team. Like, he might have gone, you know, he's going to be back as a Jet. And that's, you know, people get upset, and it's been certainly a point of emotion for Patriots fans, but it's like, it's athletes' right, you know. I would say the Patriots now, you know, a lot of the focus has been, how do you replace him? I think we need to I think one of the things in life, and not to make this philosophical podcast, is like manage expectations. You know, that's an important lesson to take with you no matter where you are. So for Patriots fans trying to figure out how do they replace Revis, well, it's not replacing him with like one guy. It's not drafting the next Darrelle Revis. It's finding ways to either reconfigure your scheme or you know, maybe reallocate your assets, whether it's like the Lions last year. Like, that secondary wasn't good. Like, it wasn't a bunch right. of good players.
Absolutely. They improved their front.
It made everything in the front seven really yeah. click. Yeah. And you remember that game, that week three game, as well as anybody against Green Bay.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they just basically, it was, we're going to have a really talented front seven. And what I think probably was one of the real pistons of that defense last year was that, like, interior pressure versus edge rushing. When you're playing a guy like Aaron, who, if you're going to have any chance of slowing him down, you better find a way to get him on the move, and even then, he's probably still going to beat you. But make him uncomfortable, and so that's the Patriots' challenge. Is they, you know, they're probably their most notable offseason addition thus far on defense is Jabal Sheard, a player who,
a good player, and a guy who I think Bill is going to be able to use in his Swiss Army knife kind of way. You know,
yep. And all of a sudden, they have three rushers with him and Rob Ninkovich and Chandler Jones. So you say to yourself, you know, does one of them end up having a role more similar to Michael Bennett? I'm not saying Michael Bennett's caliber, but Michael Bennett-like in terms of, you know, some downs he's playing on the edge, maybe half the downs he's playing is, you know, an interior rusher. So that's the challenge for the Patriots now, because as much as people love the draft, and I do too, I'm not sure there's a cornerback who's going to definitely be available at pick 32. And I also don't know that there's one. I mean, I don't think there's not a single cornerback in this class. Everybody is saying, lights out. This is, you know, a top. I mean, even last year, people were fired up for Justin Gilbert, myself included. And, you know, that certainly hasn't played out as expected. But you go back to previous
years. It's early,
seasons,
though. It's early.
Yeah. There's no Morris Claiborne in terms of, like, hype and, right, and you right. know, that kind of stuff. And again, not that Morris has been, you know, a lights out player. But you know what I'm getting at. There's not, like, a sure thing at cornerback. So it's going to be a trick for the Patriots. To get this deal, or to get this defense, reshuffled, and but this is sort of what they do, right? I mean, who replaces?
Absolutely, year in and year out.
Yep, that's what they do, and that's what they have confidence in. So the Revis one, it probably still stings to some Patriots fans, but at the same time, you know, I have a friend who sent me this once. I don't know if you guys have, like, my mom has this in her house, like, you know, one of those gone to the beach signs you hang on the door.
Yeah, of course.
Someone right. sent me a picture of one that says, in Belichick we trust. And I'm sure that's, like, hanging on a bunch of doors around New England area at some points, or right now.
Yeah, I mean, and Packers fans connect to that with their in Ted we trust. I mean,
yeah.
you see the, you know, moves year in and year out. And at some point, you know, these guys have done it and done it well for a real long time. Of the two, speaking of the Patriots again, their participation in the Super Bowl, obviously coming back as the champs. Of the teams in the Super Bowl, between them and the Seahawks, who do you think is more likely to get back to the big game? And I realize that would be three in a row for the Seahawks, which would be yeah. hella impressive. But who do you think of the two sitting here right now prior to the draft has a better chance of getting there in San Francisco?
So I'm going to make the argument for both sides, but I will ultimately go – I guess I should go with the Patriots in this regard because the AFC is weak right now. I mean, who right now – and the draft will impact rosters, of course.
But obviously.
I'm not sure there's like a pure prime contender to take down the Patriots in the AFC next year. Indianapolis will be in the mix. Denver will be in the mix. But Indianapolis is actually compelling. It's a fascinating case. Like, when was the last time? I'd be curious if it's ever happened where a team was pushed over the hump by adding several veterans.
Aging veterans on the offensive side of the ball. I hear you.
Like these are probably the final contracts of those guys' careers in terms of contracts of consequence.
Yeah.
I just don't know that's the way you put this team over the top.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in that I don't think – obviously, Andre Johnson is a talent, and he's not what he once was, but I think he will help. I think Frank Gore, I think that's one of the more underrated signings of the year. And I know, obviously, there was a lot of, you know, notoriety, brouhaha, what you will, about the whole Eagles situation and then his eventual signing in Indianapolis. But I think he's one of the most underrated players in the entire league. And I think if – you know, obviously a lot yet to play out, as we know, the draft coming up, etc. Along the front, along the offensive line, always been a problem there, both run blocking and protecting Andrew Luck. But I tend to think Frank Gore is going to make a world of difference for that offense.
Yeah, if I had to, I know we both love watching football, but like if I had to pick a player that I most enjoy, I'm not sure if he's by himself, standalone, but right. Frank Gore is like one of the probably like six or seven that I enjoy most in the NFL.
He's one of those guys who, you know, you and I, we can get into games for free basically at any point at this point. He's one of the few guys who I say I would still pay a full price admission to go see him play football. He and Steve Smith are like in the upper echelon of
guys
who I will always pay to go see.
Would 100% agree on that one. He just, you know, it's like he doesn't have any of the desirable, I shouldn't say any, but, you know, he has very few of the desirable traits of a running back right now. Like, you're looking for a guy who's like 6'2", 240 pounds, right, who can run a 4.3 40, which they don't make those, really. But, you know, if everybody could have an Adrian Peterson, they would. Frank Gore is like 5'9", 220 pounds, probably even looks smaller and thicker than that, and is not blazing speed, but just... He just piles up yards, man. And I don't care if it's a good offensive line he's playing behind or a crummy one. I have a feel. It's a good point that he probably will be effective. All that being said, back to the point of the AFC versus NFC return team. I think Seattle is a better roster, but I think that the NFC is just. I mean, let's face it. It's you could make the case that at least three of the four best teams in the NFL reside in the NFC. Certainly right now, if I had to do early preseason power rankings, the top three teams are New England, Green Bay, Seattle, in some order. So that's two out of the three. Mm-hmm. And I also think that in some people are still – I was talking about this with Danny Kelly, who runs Field Goals, one of the SB Nation's team sites for
Danny
Seattle.
Great work.
Yep. He's awesome, and he crushes it. And he and I are talking about this, and I'm like, everybody is telling me that the Seahawks still need to add a number one wide receiver in this draft. I'm thinking to myself, didn't they just do that when they traded for Jimmy Graham? So, like, their number one need this offseason was to add a number one wide receiver. And this is a good conversation to have. Like, I always believe that we get too tied down on, position assignment. Like, they need to add
Absolutely.
A number one wide receiver,
Absolutely,
tight end.
That's not, you know better than anybody, but that's just not how it works when you're drawing
up
an offense. Exactly.
It's pass catchers. And do the Seahawks now have a number one pass catcher? They do. It's just like, if we want to keep the New England example, people say they need to add another wide receiver. I'm thinking to myself, between Gronk, Amendola, or I should really say Edelman, LaFell, Amendola, Scott Chandler, they're going to have a pass catching running back. You know, they've probably got six or seven guys who are going to be catching a sufficient number of passes from Tom Brady. So let's focus more on pass catchers. So that's why I think Seattle, they filled their biggest hole already. Marshawn's coming back, and they've got, like, doesn't it seem like, I get a little bit hung up on this stuff sometimes, but they certainly have this attitude and this, like, confidence about them that's borderline contagious and infectious, even from when you're watching it from afar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anybody who's ever met John Schneider or Pete Carroll can understand why. I mean, those guys just exude exactly what you're talking about. And I agree. I think those are probably your, right now, kind of favorites, so to speak. But we know the draft will change a lot. Injuries in camp will change a lot. And speaking of the draft, let's get this out of the way right away, because you can't talk about this draft without talking about Mariota and Winston at the top. Who's your guy and why?
So if I were making the pick and understanding how the NFL works, even though I disagree with how impatient owners and decision makers are in right. the NFL, I would go with Mariota, because if this thing is going to fall flat on its face, like this quarterback pick, right. to me it feels like if you're a head coach or a GM who has to watch out for his own back, then picking the guy that has no off-field concerns. Like, if you're going to lose, like, lose, taking the high ground. And I don't know Jameis Winston. We don't have, you know, 27 stories of how he screwed up along the way. But we all know the notable incidents. I think the talent superior on Jameis Winston. I also think that this is another thing that I think is worth reminding people of is, you know, I don't want to be the guy that's like, yeah, I was talking with a bunch of scouts. I was talking with a guy that I used to work with.
Well, that's all right. You were talking to a bunch of scouts. You can say it. It's okay.
Who remains in the business. And he's like, listen. Let's be reminded that if you guys in the media had all the information from a personal standpoint on these players,
right.
I wouldn't have a job. So the Bucks know so much more about Jameis Winston than even the most connected people in the media ever could. If they're comfortable taking him, the head coach and plays Lovie Smith is a man of character. The Glazer family, I think, is looking to avoid who owns a team, is looking to avoid some sort of repeat of a first-round quarterback gone wrong, because Josh Freeman, which was 2009 or 10, 2010 draft, certainly didn't work out. So I think it's possible that if they take him, they're comfortable. So if it was me making the pick, I'd go Marcus. Based on talent alone, it's Jameis. At this point, I will say this. I'd be surprised if it wasn't Jameis, no matter how much smoke we could hear about Marcus. Yeah. Going number one, I would be surprised. Personally, I will be very surprised if it's not Jameis number one overall.
See, it's interesting. You talk about, if you're going to go down. To me, with Mariota and Winston, I think you take Winston simply because he's going to give you more years initially. He's going to give you more success initially. I think Mariota is great. I think he's a very talented quarterback. I think he could possibly have a very long, prosperous year in the NFL or career in the NFL. I think a big part of it for him, it matters where he ends up, whereas I don't think it matters as much with Winston. I think they're both, again, really super talented. I think they're both have, the ceiling is super high on both guys. But for me, Mariota's possible success in the league, it's a lot more on where he ends up, who the coaching staff is, how they use him early. Obviously, I think he's probably going to have to play right away, and I don't think that's great for him. I think Winston's going to be fine being thrown into the fire right away.
Yeah, certainly if they go 1-2 and the teams that they get drafted by are currently picking 1-2, like Tampa's a natural fit for Jameis based off what they're doing down there, the receivers they have, etc. The offensive line's still a disaster, which I think is the underplayed story of this draft season, is how bad the Tampa offensive line is and how much it has not been addressed this offseason.
Absolutely.
But for Marcus, like going to Tennessee, we know the quote unquote like whiz preferences, big drop back passer like Phillip Rivers. I agree. And one thing, one thing that I have a hard time with on the media side versus now being on the team side is like there's certainly an aura sometimes on the media side that like we have it figured out more so than those who are running. Like we make it seem like it's an easy process, the draft and evaluation of players, et cetera. And it's like when NFL teams don't pick up a play, like Teddy Bridgewater, there's been a lot of like I told you so from the NFL community to the immediate. Right. Listen, 30. Or whatever it was. I guess there were a couple teams that had two picks last year. 28 or 29 teams passed on Teddy Bridgewater, and some of them certainly had a needed quarterback. It's not like this was a personal thing. It's just they didn't believe it. And it turns out he's proved them, at least the early returns, look pretty good. But on Marcus, but one thing I will say that I wish the league did a better job of, it feels like to me that if you invest in a player, it shouldn't be how does he fit into our system. It should be how do we alter our system to make sure that he is utilizing the best way.
Well, that we're maximizing his talent, absolutely.
At quarterback specifically, because it's the most important position on the field. To me, that's just coaching in a nutshell. So if I'm Tennessee and I draft Marcus Mariota and he stays with us and you just want to make him like what other quarterbacks who have played for Ken Wisenhunt are, whether it's going back to Arizona.
I think that's disaster. Right. I think that is absolute disaster.
That's chasing ghosts and it's silly. It's like, hey, let's sign. If the Mavericks move on from Dirk Nowitzki one day and sign some guy who plays in the post, then tell him to shoot a bunch of threes. Why would you do that?
Right. And to me, this happens again and again and again in the NFL. And you talk about, yes, of course, we don't have the information, but I do think NFL teams, personnel people, etc., tend to make things a little more complicated than they need to be, especially NFL coaches, where you see this again and again. You see it playing out with Robert Griffin III. You saw it play out with Colin Kaepernick. You've got guys who are talented, but for whatever reason, the NFL kind of mindset is we have got to mold these guys into our way. Why? Why the hell does that need to happen? You saw how successful RG3 was in the system that they ran initially when he was a rookie. Yes, he got injured. Injuries happen. Everybody's injured in the NFL. Colin Kaepernick, he never got injured. They just started asking him to do stuff that he's not very good at. Go back to what he was good at. I just hate that we have this kind of mindset of you can only win from the pocket. Well, yeah, guys have only won from the pocket because that's all we've allowed guys to do throughout their careers. We've asked them to be stuff that they're not when they've come up the ranks, whether from the college ranks to put them in the NFL. Look how successful Colin Kaepernick was early. He's one bad, maybe borderline pass interference away from a Super Bowl championship being on his resume.
Yep.
And now all of a sudden we start spreading it out with 3, 4, 5 wide receivers on the field, asking him to make these quick decision reads, etc., from a spread system that he's never run, definitely not successfully, when just a year ago you were running read option pistol stuff and it was gangbusters. He was on fire. Why this need to put guys in this quote NFL box? It drives me insane.
I have a theory on this. So just to offer some potential reason why. Mm-hmm. So, as you spend time around plenty of NFL coaches, and I would say that, one of the things you have to have if you're a coach is confidence and vision. And so I do think that sometimes it's a belief in their own system. Hey, I see the traits needed from Colin to run this system, and this is the system that I'm most comfortable with, so we're going to make it work. And it's like, I'd rather try and fail than never try at all. That would be my only theory, just because it's like, with the Bears having a new coaching staff this year, there were some questions about, hey, are the Bears going to try to move on from Jay Cutler? Can you trade him? Do you cut him? I guarantee you when Adam Gase, their new offensive coordinator, was hired to that job officially, I probably would imagine he spent a couple of days watching Jay Cutler. And although there are so many bad plays that you can highlight and say, all right, gosh, this guy's hopeless, he probably saw Jay Cutler will make at least one throw. I usually call this the Matthew Stafford throw. There's at least one throw per game that says makes you go, holy crap. Yep. That is incredibly difficult to do. So I'm sure Adam Gase and the coaching staff looked at those plays and said, we're going to find a way to develop those habits more consistently. And so that would be the reason why coaches probably get hung up on the player fitting their system as opposed to cutting bait for the player or evolving your system to fit the player's strengths. Because you're right, it does – it's an issue in the NFL, and I do like we had some ugly offensive football from probably close to 16 or 18 teams last year.
It's striking, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, it really is. Obviously, a lot is down to the haves and haves not at the quarterback position, but even outside of that, it's you're watching, Manning, Rodgers, Brady. And you're just having a ball, and it's beautiful to watch, and sometimes they're facing great defenses, and it's great chess match, etc. And then there are the freaking games, and obviously the war of attrition with injuries at the quarterback position played a lot to do with this down the stretch in the year. But holy cow, there are some rudimentary, West Coast offense 101 stuff going on out there that is just hard to watch.
And sometimes it's also it's not even teams that have bad personnel. Like I find, and maybe he's not great, but I have my eyes bleed when I watch Cincinnati play sometimes because they have so much talent from, eight or nine of the positions.
Right.
And then the quarterback can just go silent in some games. But then you watch the game against Denver, the Monday Nighter in like week 14 last year.
Crazy.
Awesome game. And it's a game that, based off the weather conditions, gusting winds and torrential downpour, you're supposed to score like 6 points, and they light Denver up for however many points it was, and Bernard catches, six passes out of the backfield, and Jeremy Hill runs wild. So, yeah, it's an interesting time right now. I think there was a lot of debate, a lot of angst over the poor quality of offensive play in college basketball this year. Maybe we should have that conversation about the NFL, because some of this offense is just, wow, it's not easy.
Yeah, it's hard to watch. All right, sticking with the draft for a little bit, going down to the inside linebacker position, obviously there's a big cluster of guys You know, and I think a lot of it is going to be dependent on, obviously, scheme, where teams see guys fitting in that scheme, etc. Is there a guy, you know, amongst kind of the wash of Anthony, Kendricks, you know, Dawson, etc., is there a guy that you like more than the rest?
So without, this is not an original thought, but Kendricks is definitely the one that I like the most. But, you know, and I don't want to raise red flags about a guy because it's I'm not in the draft room. But, you know, the two things that you consistently hear with Kendricks are, one, he's small. You know, I think he's under 6 feet. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious when the last time a under 6 foot first round linebacker was taken. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but it feels like that's an uncommon thing.
Right.
You know, he was hampered by the hamstring injury throughout the pre-draft process, didn't run at the combine.
Yeah.
And it seems like injuries could be something. I know Bob McGinn had something, I believe it was in his linebackers piece when he talks to, you know, mm-hmm. extensive personnel people, said something to the effect of, you know, he may have even had failed or medical evaluations on some team's boards. So the injury and the size are the two concerns. And I don't want to dumb down football and tape evaluation, but like, he's a guy that makes plays. You know, I remember,
right.
I live in Boston and there's a legendary bar that's actually just shut down called Daisy Buchanan's. And it's right around the corner from where I live. It's like where the Red Sox always go after they win the World Series, et cetera. And I remember like my last time going there, I was like, I got to get one last time in. It was a Saturday night. And I think UCLA was playing USC or something. And it was this great Pac-12 game. And I'm watching and I'm thinking to myself, I don't love the quarterback on UCLA because Hundley was playing like, you know, not so great. And then, but I love the linebacker. And it's like, he's just one of those guys that you don't have to really spend too much time looking for him. He just appears.
Yeah.
That's probably a linebacker by nature. But like if I were, for example, the Packers at pick 29 or 30, then maybe, you know, maybe that makes some sense. At the same time, you know, I think that this might be one of those drafts where there isn't like a clear-cut first-round guy that maybe the value, and we know that the best teams understand the value, like maybe the better value is snagging an inside linebacker at 61 or 62 and passing on the guy at 30 and, you know, letting someone else take him.
Right, be the end of the run instead of the start of it because, you know, we talked to Eric Stoner last week about that very thing. They're so, to me, they are all very close. There's not one that's jumping out over the other. So, yeah, I definitely agree with that. Speaking of drafting guys too early, where do we rank Deion Jordan in the pantheon of great NFL draft busts?
Yeah, it's got to be up there, right?
God.
And here's
number three, third overall. Yep. Are you kidding me?
And you trade Holy up for God. Him. So they traded their first and Holy second God. Round picks. Their first pick that year was like 12
mm-hmm.
to Oakland.
Yep.
So they gave their first and second rounder, and Oakland being Oakland turned it into DJ Hayden, and I don't even know their second round pick was.
Right.
But so here's what I'll say. Here's the cautionary tale I think I learned from Deion Jordan is so one of the first rules of scouting. This is one thing that Bill Belichick imparts from the day you walk in the door is we don't draft production, we draft traits, right?
Yep.
And Jordan wasn't a production guy. He had, like, you know, a handful of sacks in college. But you sit there and think to yourself, he's 6'4", he's 250 pounds,
insane
he can run.
Athlete. Insane. That Oregon yep. tape is still ridiculous if you watch it.
It's crazy. You know, he was their gunner. He was, you know, playing. You know, he was a safety on some snaps. But one thing that I just don't know, and I made this mistake in some ways on Melvin Ingram as well, the Chargers outside linebacker, because I thought he actually played pretty well during the 2014 season. But I get a little bit concerned when it's like, I don't know what the guy's position is. Like, what's his one go-to spot? I think there is some value to that. Like, it's great to have a movable chess piece, but it's also good to have a home. And I didn't know what Deion Jordan's home was. I think we all can agree it wasn't supposed to be a 4-3 defensive end.
No.
And a 3-4 outside linebacker, that probably was the natural projection. You know, Miami is, I don't know, within 2 years or 3 years, two seasons since they drafted him, you know, their defense has had some seismic shifts. So, yeah, it's up there. It's a bad pick, man. And
yeah. And it's funny, I think you mentioned Miami. I think they're kind of culpable in the sense that, not obviously for his bad decision-making off the field, but for the fact that it took forever for them to kind of, A, get him on the field and utilize his skill set. But you saw him last year, you know, running down the field with Calvin Johnson and doing it pretty well. That stuff he was doing at Oregon, why it took, you know, years for them to go, oh, wait, we have this really athletic guy who plays outside who not only can rush the quarterback, but also take on number one targets, you know, 30 yards down the field. Why it took so long for them to kind of self-evaluate that, I'll never know.
It's like going back to that quarterback thing, you know? Why do you,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely
the system versus the traits. So it is, that one was confusing. And I'll say this, it is easy to pile on play people who make poor decisions, whether it's Shane Ray this week or Deion Jordan. His,
right.
Maybe this is me being a sucker, but I do hope for Deion Jordan's sake, like he cleans up whatever it is he needs to clean up, because whether he makes a return to the NFL is a different discussion for a different time. But you know, he's a kid. He's a kid, a young kid, and I'm a kid, but this guy's even younger than I am. And, you know, you do hope that he gets back on the straight and narrow at some point here in the next, you know, soon.
Looking at all the new coaching hires this offseason, we've got Dan Quinn, we got John Fox, Rex Ryan, Todd Bowles, and Jack Del Rio.
Yeah.
We got some new blood and some retreads. Who do you think of that group is going to have the most success right out of the gate? In other words, 2015, they're winning football games and, you know, maybe not leaving the other guys in the dust, but noticeably they're having a better season than the rest. Who do you think that is?
So are we expanding this to all the seven hires? Because, you know, like Gary Kubiak would be...
Oh, right, Kubiak's in there, of course.
Yeah, yes. So Kubiak...
he's got Peyton Manning, so that's like, you know, I was trying to leave him out of it. But
I totally understood. if you look at those teams, I think long range, I'm enthused by the Atlanta hire. And I think sometimes people get on me. They're like, yeah, you just like Atlanta. You're excited
about Pioli connection. I get it.
Do I have faith that they're going to get things right? I do. But also, and I don't, maybe this doesn't matter because football is not like, you know, a contest of kindness. But I remember when Dan Quinn's name has been in the rumor cycle for, you know,
forever. Yeah.
But really, the past two off seasons, it's really heated up. And separate and apart, we know he's a capable coach, especially a defensive coach. But everybody's like, this guy is just like otherworldly in terms of like his personality. Like, he's just an awesome person, like the kind of guy that players can easily relate to. Now, you need good players. You know, relating to players is one thing, but relating to good players is another thing. I just think that Atlanta long term has a chance to be better. There's been a lot of smoke about them trading up this draft. Personally, I'd like to think that they would hold off because I think there's going to be an edge rusher for them right there at pick 8. But nonetheless, they have the quarterback,
which puts him ahead of everybody. Well, not everybody else, but like, yeah, that is
pretty much everybody.
You talk about, you know, Bradley down in Jacksonville. You know, obviously now he's got Bortles, but Bortles is no Matt Ryan. And it's funny how Bradley, I think, is a very good football coach, but he could, you know, be sunk right out of the gate because he doesn't have a quarterback. I mean, we don't know, obviously, what Bortles is going to end up to be. That jury is out. But Matt Ryan is a viable NFL quarterback, and a pretty darn good one.
Yep.
And I think that enables Quinn to have success right out of the gate.
Completely agree. And that division's not strong. New Orleans,
right.
Who knows? I don't know what New Orleans... I'm not saying I don't know what New Orleans' outlook is for 2015 because I disagree with what they did. I just don't know because, you know, you trade away your second or third best player.
You disagree with what they did in regards to trading away Jimmy Graham, etc.?
I don't know. I haven't figured it out.
Pass catchers?
Because here's the reason why I want to, you know, principally think to yourself, maybe the, you know, second best tight end in the NFL. Pretty comfortably, obviously. Trading him away.
Yeah, I think he's a guy who feasts on weak competition.
That's a fair point. So that's when it's almost like.
But there's a lot of weak competition in the NFL. So
that's true.
All right.
Well, I had this. So my thought is, it's like when a team lets a good player walk in free agency without making a competitive offer. There's more they know about that guy than we do.
Yep.
So New Orleans, I'm wondering if there's more they know about Jimmy Graham than we do, but I also think Seattle's really smart.
Especially, you know, after signing him to that deal and then sending him away. That's interesting.
That's the part that's why I'm reserving judgment entirely on them. And then also, they have a quarterback still. Whether or not you think Drew Brees has 1 year left or three, they still have Drew. And that counts for quite a bit, especially in a league where, as we know, teams are starving for a good quarterback. Josh McCown is worth $20 million more than I am over the next 3 years.
Oh, man, that starving is the correct word there. I tell you what, I like what the Saints did. I think partly a lot of it obviously has to do with what happens over this week, you know, over this upcoming weekend. I think they are all in on this draft in regards to becoming a more run-based offense.
Mm-hmm.
I think they you know, obviously some of it is Peyton knowing that he can make it work in the passing game with a lot of nondescript pass catchers, and or he's got some talent on board already. But I think they will run the ball more. I think the game plan you saw against the Packers on that Sunday night game, I think you're going to see a lot more of that going forward in 2015. A lot of power football, a lot of play action stuff. Obviously, a recommitment to solidifying the interior of that line. Obviously, that was part of that trade.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I fell for the Saints hard last year in the preseason. I thought they were going to go to the Super Bowl, and then obviously they fell apart. I'm not ready to say they're Super Bowl contenders, but if that's the route they go, get a little tougher on offense, and obviously they had their problems on defense. Got to shore some stuff up there, but I don't know. I like the direction they're heading if that is indeed where they're pointed.
The offensive line isn't as good, and they don't have Dez Bryant, but this is what Dallas did last year in some ways.
Absolutely.
They reconfigured their offense, well, and they took pressure off of a quarterback who's got, you know, has had an injury history, mm-hmm. and let's face it.
And probably a turnover problem.
Yeah. It behooves a team to take pressure off of any quarterback. Tony Romo, who the narrative is overplayed, but there have been moments where he has come up short in pressing times. And by the way, I didn't mean to. So you picked the Saints last year. I have a question. Like, and obviously everybody knows your affinity for the Packers. Is there, like, do you feel like a need every year, like every few years, to like not pick the Packers to be successful or anything like that? Because I know, so I continue to do, each week they have me pick the Patriots game during the season on ESPN Boston, along with Mike Reese and Teddy Bruschi and a couple other guys. And, I mean, I might pick against them like once or twice a year. I mean, like, they went to Green Bay last year. I picked the Packers.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to pat myself on the back.
That's funny because I picked the Patriots in that game.
There you go. But, like, it's not that – like, if you pick the Packers every single year, especially with the current core that they have, like, I wouldn't think, oh, my God, you have no idea how to analyze football.
Such a homer. Right.
I'd be like, okay, yeah, they have the best player in football and a really smart GM. And maybe this won't – I don't know how this will go over with some of the listeners here, but, like, a really, really good head coach and awesome receivers and some of that stuff, you know?
Yeah. No, it's hard. It's funny because – that is funny you mentioned it. Because every year I pick them to go either 11-5 or 12-4. And people say, you always, you know, picking the same thing. And it's – well, that's because that's who they are. They're steady. They're really talented. They got really smart people, you know, up front and behind and whatever. Last year I picked them to lose in the NFC Championship game. I had the team wrong, but I was correct in that regard. Although they were, like, what, 5 minutes away from the Super Bowl, and I was looking like I was going to be incorrect, and I was really happy about it.
Yeah.
but, yeah, it's interesting. I try to be as realistic as possible. Obviously, I'm a huge fan. I love the green and gold, grew up with them, etc. I try to look at it as objectively as possible. And I just – it's funny, too, because I think in that regard, like, after kind of camp and preseason plays out, I do tend to kind of maybe overinflate some of the issues that I see. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that is kind of a reaction to, I don't want to be called a mega homer, even though I know I am. But like I said, I just try to be as realistic as possible. Now this year I am of the opinion, and of course draft has yet to play out. Camp has yet to come and go along with the attendant injuries. But I'm of the opinion sitting here in late April that the Packers are going to win the Super Bowl. Now, I rarely say that in the offseason, but this season, I think, you know, if things fall the way I think they will, I think they're going to be in San Francisco come next February. But there is a lot to play out yet.
Be kind of a nice little couple of Bay Area quarterbacks, you know, facing off in the Super Bowl if it was the Patriots and the Packers. And by the way, we've already asked the question a bunch of times on our airwaves, and it will continue to be asked until we get to probably closer to training camp. You know, who had the best offseason? And, you know, I was getting flack from people like, you picked the Packers. What did they do? I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, they just re-signed their two best free agents, you know, like that.
And also, two of the best free agents had they hit the market.
Yep,
that's
exactly
what people keep discounting. That's what I love.
Well, and not only that, the second best player in that division, or one of the five best players in that division at the very least, is no longer in the division. And Ndamukong Suh now is worth, you know, like $12 billion in Miami. So that's a win, you know? So, could I see Seattle doing it again? Of course I could, but to me, it's like pretty clearly, you know, Seattle, New Orleans, or not New Orleans, excuse me, Green Bay, maybe Arizona, depending on how everybody comes back to health.
And then Arizona, the two biggest things for me for Arizona, Do they get a run? Do they find a running back?
Yeah.
Is that running back Adrian Peterson? I doubt it. But maybe it's Gurley. Maybe it's Gordon. Who knows?
Yep.
Do they find a running back? And then B, it's all well and good to think, okay, they're going to come back and do what they did last year. We all know that rarely happens. The big question is what happens on the defensive side of the ball. Obviously, Todd Bowles did such a great job with that unit. Loved their attacking style. Loved kind of the mixing and matching of their, you know, all the different sub packages on the defensive side. How does that continue? Like, how are they the same kind of attacking blitz the hell out of the quarterback on third down, etc., that they were last year? It's hard to see how that plays out.
I would think so. And here's one thing that I'm keeping an eye on for Thursday night. We all heard that quote from their GM, Steve Keim, who said, I might be missing it.
Quote of the year.
If Hannibal Lecter ran a 4.3, we'd diagnose him with an eating disorder, which is just an absolute classic, great scouting line right there. And it made me think that, you know, we have all these guys that are now slipping, quote unquote. And people think that, like, draft boards are stagnant at this point of the process. I'm telling you, like, up until the freaking draft itself, I have sat there and I have adjusted a draft board inside of a draft room. And someone said, hey, you know, like, just here's our final adjustment. The pre-draft process is gathering information. So don't, and if you have more information and it allows you to make a more comprehensive and in turn altered perception of a player, that's what the board does move. So I just wanted to mention that. But I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but that quote made me think about the idea that, you know something, Arizona could be that sweet spot at pick 24 to snag one of these players who has an off-field issue at the tail end of the pre-draft process but has an abundance of talent, whether it's a Randy Gregory, a Shane Ray, maybe it's even a running back. If Melvin Gordon lasts until 24, one of these guys could fall right into their laps, and I think they're one or two pieces away and a healthy Carson Palmer away from being very legit. They have a tough division, and Seattle's right there, but I don't know. I think there's a reason. I think that the optimism for Arizona, it's well founded. It's not, you know,
absolutely
we're not just
agree.
Sitting there trying to make a good story out of a likable organization.
Right. And I couldn't agree more. Been talking to Field Yates here on Nagler's Never Right. Field, you are an absolute legend for coming on. I got one final question for you.
Let's do it. In regards
to your duties there at ESPN to cover the draft, first of all, where are you going to be covering? Are you going to be in Chicago or are you going to be there in Bristol?
I will be in Bristol, so I'm heading down tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, day of the draft, and getting the lay of the land. And I've looked at my schedule. I think it's, you know, I've got segments on SportsCenter stuff sort of lined up. But as you know, in this business, it's, you know, things can change quickly, and
it's
they can say,
fluid.
"Hey, we need you in 10 minutes." You know, so
absolutely.
I'm keeping myself on my toes throughout the weekend.
So, in regards to covering the draft, I wanted to know where you fell on the great tipping picks debate, because every year, lead up to the draft, we have the brouhaha about, don't tip the picks. And now the NFL has sent out a directive to its broadcast partners, tell your people not to tip the picks, etc. Where do you fall along that line?
See, I look at the draft as in some ways like a game. And if you knew the outcome of a game, like if you're watching that Clippers-Spurs game last night, and you know you knew the outcome of it like 30 seconds before it was over, I wouldn't want to know. I would want to watch like that last dramatic 15 or 20 seconds. I think there's, I mean, is there value in tipping the picks? Like on, you know, and both the networks, as you mentioned, are not doing it this year. But like, is there value in tweeting the picks if you know them ahead of time, which we know some people either have done in previous years or will do?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you like retweets and potentially new followers, there probably is. But I don't know.
Right.
Like, it's the draft. There are certain bits of news that I really applaud some of the colleagues that I work with or people that are in the media that I say, dang, like that's really good. But like when it's a deadline thing, I think to myself, what I'm more curious in now is rather than the news, because we knew the first pick was going to have to be made at some point, or we knew the sixth pick's going to have to be made at some point, or we know the Packers are going to take a pick 30.
Right.
Let's focus more on what it means. That's, to me, that is where I think that is what I enjoy the most, like consuming media-wise, and it's why, I mean, there are so many good people doing it in the football landscape, that it's not just, it's the facts, but it's also what does it mean for them going forward, or what does it mean for other players in the roster, et cetera, which is where I get geeked up about. So that's why I'm like, if you know the pick, you can keep it to yourself. Now, that's on me also to either, you know, mute people on my Twitter feed or whatever it is.
But I'd be
just okay with letting the commissioner come up there and, you know, stand behind a microphone, throw on a smile and say.
I think you know, they've done a great job. The NFL has done a great job of turning the draft into entertainment. And yep. the commissioner or, you know, whoever on day two or three announcing the pick is a big part of that. I don't know. I struggle with it. Because on the other side, you know, you can read everything about it on Monday morning in the paper or Sunday morning in the paper. And the fact that, you know, you might know 30 seconds before, just turn. Don't look at Twitter. How hard is that?
Yep.
If you want to know exactly when it happens and someone's got that information, I want to know, as a fan, I want to know ASAP who the Packers have taken. So I look at Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, so, and if I don't want to look at, you know, I don't want to know that information, I don't look at Twitter. So I don't know. I can see both sides of the
yep.
argument. So there you go.
We're at the day and age where people can make a choice, which is the best part about it. If you want, like you said,
it's called a second screen for a reason.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway. There you go. Field Yates dropping knowledge bombs. Field, can't thank you enough. Good luck this weekend covering the draft there for ESPN.
Thank you, my friend. Let me ask you quickly before I go.
Yeah.
Perfect Packers pick. Do you have a guy that you're like, if we get him at 30, I'm good?
I get asked this a lot, a whole lot. And, yep. you know, I would love if Malcolm Brown fell into their lap. I don't think that's going to happen. I wouldn't mind most of the inside linebacker prospects. I'd love it if Ted finagled a trade down. Although not from a production standpoint, because we will be covering it here at CheeseheadTV.com. We'll be live streaming when the Packers are on the clock. And if they trade back, that doesn't do a whole lot for me content-wise. But from a football standpoint, I'd love it. I think the way, you know, the drafts always are, that there are, you know, 8, 9, maybe 10 guys. And then after that, it's all in the eye of the beholder.
Sure.
And I think especially in that range, I just mentioned this morning on Twitter, people get so caught up in, they can't take him. The Packers can't take him at 30. He's not a first-round prospect. Two picks later, it's the second round.
That's right.
Like, it just, that boggles my mind. Like, it's all about system fit, etc. at that point. So, there's no one guy where I'm just like, they've got to get him. I'm going to love pretty much anybody Ted picks.
I'm with you.
All right, man. Thanks so much for jumping on, and we'll be you know, following your work there at the mothership.
Let's do it. Hey, let's do it again sometime. How about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. We'll do it sooner rather than later.
All right, my friend.
Thanks, Field. Have a great day.
You too.